everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we have Kim Jensen on the show. Her book, Mobilizing Minerva, American Women in the First World War, has just appeared from the University of Illinois Press. We're very happy to have Kim on the show today, not only because she is a distinguished historian, but also because she's a graduate of the PhD program here at the University of Iowa. I enjoyed talking to Kim about Mobilizing Minerva, and I learned a lot about women in the First World War. I suspect you'll do the same. Here's the interview. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
I'm pretty well. You know, the weather here is beautiful in Iowa, kind of extraordinarily beautiful. It's been a very cool spring, but we're doing pretty well. As long as it stays cool this summer, I'll be okay. How is it in Oregon?
Oregon has had a rainy spring, which is not surprising, but we've had beautiful days in between. This is one of them. It's just gorgeous.
Well, that's great. No, I know Oregon is beautiful. I've spent some time there myself. I should say to the listeners, today we have Kim Jensen on the show, and we'll be talking with her about Mobilizing Minerva, American Women in the First World War. And it's just come out from the University of Illinois Press. Is that right, University of Illinois? Do I remember that right?
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Kim teaches at Western Oregon University, and she's in history and gender studies there. Kim, why don't you begin by telling our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
I'd be delighted to. I was born and grew up in Denver, Colorado, and I found myself at the time that I was young and an adolescent, really very interested in the women's movement. I was born in 1958, and my consciousness as a human being was also at a time when there were many very important movements, of course, in the United States, and the feminist movement was certainly a part of that. And I also connected fairly early on in terms of thinking historically with my grandmother, who had been trained as a nurse and had herself been involved in the Red Cross in the First World War, and
really
thought a lot about those kinds of connections with the movements that were happening as I was a young person. And so I was always very interested in history, but I think thinking about how I might work out a feminist identity, and so history was a very important way of coming to terms with the condition of women and my situation and thinking about that. I knew very much that I wanted to study history. I wanted to study women's history. I did my graduate work with Linda Kerber and wanted very much to study with her at the University of Iowa. But I wasn't quite sure that I knew I wanted to do United States history, but I took a seminar on women in war with Linda, and that was the origin, really, of being able to connect my own grandmother's experience with my own research. And so I started, at that point, doing research on women nurses and their experience, and there was just an incredible amount of material. One could look at individual-based hospitals or could try to chart leaders or try to think about that. So I started early with that and then tried to think about other groups of women in that conflict that might be interesting to study or might be fruitful to study. And the thing that was clear as well was that this was a time period in the United States in which the movement for suffrage was coming to its final years. And although the participants didn't know that, there were many states that had women had achieved suffrage in a number of states prior to World War I. So ideas about citizenship and even citizenship beyond the vote, what does that mean for women? What they were working this out for themselves, and so the war came at that particular time. So my sense was that there were some interesting questions that we could ask about women's participation in the war that would also relate to their ideas about citizenship. And so that was really the origin of this particular study. I added women physicians, mm-hmm. and I was able to study the archives of what used to be the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania. It's mm-hmm. now the Drexel University College of Medicine Archives, mm-hmm. and so I was able to initially get a grant to study there, and then mm-hmm. complete some additional work on the women at arms that eventually mm-hmm. would be a part of this study as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were much more focused than I was very early on. I can tell you that.
But I think that what I, you know, and particularly at the time that I was working on my dissertation, which was the late 80s and early 90s, there were studies that were coming out about Barbara Steinson's work, for example, on women in the war, focused on women in the peace movement and you know, women who were preparing for war. Uh-huh. There were people sort of just cataloging the, you know, hundreds of thousands of women in the U.S. and in other warring nations that participated in what this meant. And so, uh-huh. no, my early work was really, you know, trying to find as many women as possible. And so my continuing work focused and began to also really ask questions about what did they think when they were calling for participation in the military? Did they want to shape their place in the military in some way, or their place in war? Did they want to help to redefine what war meant, or to address particularly the ways in which war, the First World War, brought violence to women, whether it was women civilians in the path of war, or intimate or domestic violence at home, or gender-based hostility and yeah. hostile environment in the workplace. So that those kinds of threads certainly came later as I was working on revising the study. So it's been a study that I've worked on for a long time, but yeah. also I think has been I've had a chance to try to deepen the analysis mm-hmm, mm-hmm, by asking mm-hmm. some additional kinds of questions.
Well, you've done a terrific job, and I hope you find a wide readership. Before we actually launch into a discussion of the three groups you deal with in the general context, could you put the book in a broader kind of historiographical context? I was wondering what had been written about American women during the First World War prior to your study. This is not my field, I should say. I study something very yeah. obscure. But could you name a few of the people that were influential, or what was known yeah. about women in the world in World War I, that kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely. Barbara Steinson's work, American Women's Activism in World War I, was published in 1982. Mm-hmm. And again, her focus was activism and looking at women in the peace movement and women who joined various organizations. Certainly, her work was really pioneering, and that came 2 years after Linda Kerber's work on women of the Republic and uh-huh. thinking about women's citizenship and relationship to the state. So there's also the broader historiographic mm-hmm. context of women and citizenship and wartime. Mm-hmm. There certainly Kathleen Kennedy's work that looks at the challenges, what happened to women who did not support the war and who challenged the militarism of the war was very important. This is Disloyal Mothers and Scurrilous Citizens, uh-huh. Women in Subversion during World War I. Mm-hmm. Her work really drew upon Steinson's idea of patriotic motherhood, mm-hmm. and that became an iconic role for women, and mm-hmm. indeed women who deviated from that were harassed or imprisoned or mm-hmm. lost work and so forth. So mm-hmm. she also really contributed to that. And so Kim Nielsen's work on un-American womanhood, anti-radicalism uh-huh. and anti-feminism, also provided another view of women whose activism was not toward feminist citizenship in the regular sense, or in the sense we're dealing with. And then also Susan Zeiger's work in Uncle Sam's Service was a look at women workers with the American Expeditionary Force. And so her view was particularly to look at how women were part of the military workforce. So it included nurses, it included women who worked with the Signal Corps, and and thinking about, in her conclusion, sort of the meaning of that service. So that's there's an important tradition in the United States, and then also, of course, a very important tradition in thinking about women in other belligerent nations. And so, you know, the anthology on women in the first two world wars and sort of beyond that, and looking at the work of many women who are looking at how motherhood, how maternalism, how challenges to women's citizenship became reinscribed after the First World War as well.
It's very interesting because there does seem to be quite a literature on this topic, and I was completely unaware of it. One of the great things about doing this podcast is I get to read outside my discipline, and I get to discover all these sort of rich veins like this one of people that are discussing, you know, topics that I knew next to nothing about. So let's turn directly to the book itself, and maybe you can set it up by answering a question that I had and is, in fact, answered in the book, and that is, what did Americans in general, I'm asking you to speculate just a little bit here, think about women's participation in what we might generally call martial activities at the onset of the First World War?
I think that there was a great deal of suspicion and, in many ways, confusion on the part of Americans at large about the implications of women participating in martial activity. Nurses could be cast as nurturing women, even members of a religious tradition, if you will, so that they could be cast and had been cast as nurturers in the Clara Barton, Florence Nightingale battlefields. Women were not threatening because they were there to do women's work, and women physicians had been a part of wartime as contract surgeons and so forth. Because the United States entered the conflict later, one of the interesting things about American popular culture is that we can try to get a sense and try to gauge some of the reactions to women as soldiers or women as combatants, because there were reports of Serbian women, of Russian women, of German women who were a part of that prior to the United States entry.
So there was commentary about these things before the United States entered authority. That's interesting.
Yeah, who were there. And so, and that's also the case, and part of my study looks at the popular reaction in the United States to the Russian Women's Battalion of Death as not just individual women soldiers, but groups of women. And so in some ways, individual women were explained in ways that were acceptable, so that they were fighting for their fallen husband, or they were looking for a brother on the battlefield. I mean, there were many narratives that arose to help explain that, but they were also narratives about patriotism. And so, in some ways, those individual women, not all women who would follow them, but those individual women could find an accepted place because they because of the way in which their activities were explained. And in many, many cases, and this is certainly true of the Battalion of Death from Moscow and also in Kiev, but as the United States learned about this, as popular magazines and newspapers are reporting about them, they were seen as shaming men into service. And so that was there for a patriotic duty.
Yeah, if you could if you could talk to us a little bit about the Battalion of Death. I am a sometimes Russian historian myself, and I had heard of the Battalion of Death. There were similar sorts of things during World War II. But if you could just say a few words about it and the American reaction to it, I think that we'd all be interested in hearing about it. That's quite a name, the Battalion of Death.
Well, essentially, there were a number of women's regiments, and they emerge at a particular point in revolutionary Russia, and essentially to support the Kerensky regime and to try to continue the Russian presence in World War One, of course, before revolution continues and so forth, and civil war begins. And so they represent, I think, to an American audience, and certainly the commentary is there, women who are urging men to participate, and in fact their participation is to shame Russian men into fighting. And so their leader, Bochkareva, made a U.S. tour. She had an autobiography. Mm. There's a lot of press about her, and the lessons seemed to be for the journals and the newspapers that I found. The lessons seemed to be that at a time when in the United States there were also questions about the United States participation and increasingly concerns about that, and so a conflict there, they represented one mode of women's patriotism, which would be to fight not because you want to redefine what it means to be a woman, but because you're using your womanhood to get men to fulfill their role of being protectors.
I see. But there wasn't any call in the United States to form, even during the war, a American Battalion of Death, or to put arms into the hands of female units? Was there anything like that?
Well, part of what I address in the book is that there were a number of, quite a few actually, of women's rifle clubs, women's defense groups, and so forth. And these really emerged during the preparedness phase.
Yeah, the run-up to the war,
About that, prior to the conflict.
Uh-huh.
And so there were, for example, the American Women's League of Self-Defense had infantry drill in New York and had a cavalry drill. And there were other groups that not only wanted to teach women how to shoot and how to march, but also really that sense that should, and this relates also to how the United States looked at the war in Europe and the idea that Belgium had been invaded, northern France had been invaded. There was discussion that, you know, these men had failed their women. They were not acting as the protectors that they should have, and or at least in the minds of those who were writing about it. And so there is a sense that perhaps if the war should come to the United States, that, you know, men might similarly fail here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a powerful subtext here, which is that women may also be able to defend themselves against intimate violence or domestic violence.
Who is responsible for the notion that the Belgian or French men had failed their women? It's very interesting in the sense that it can't really have been true, if you see what I mean.
Of course, absolutely. But there was a sense that, again, wartime, it's such an interesting paradox. The First World War offered the possibility to challenge traditional gender roles, but also to reinscribe the idea of the protector and the protected.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a lot of discussion. Part of that has to do with the very powerful, and there's just a lot of this discussion about the rape of Belgium, atrocity tales. Certainly, as we look back over the space of about 100 years, yes, rapes happened, but it was also the case that there was a great deal of atrocity making for the purposes of, you know, creating the enemy.
Yeah, actually, I found this part of the book very enlightening, actually, because I had been taught that the rape of Belgium and the rape of Belgian women by the German forces was entirely made up by the Allied propagandists. But I guess there's some new research that shows that this isn't quite right, that actually there's a basis in reality to some of these claims.
That's certainly the case. And I also think that as we look for example, one of the physicians that whose work I look at in the book is named Esther Cole Lovejoy. And she wrote about her experiences investigating. She was sent essentially by the Medical Women's National Association, mm-hmm. Women's Council Committee on the Council of National Defense, to go to France with the Red Cross on sort of their investigative mission in the fall of 1917, mm-hmm. and to try to determine the situation, particularly for women and children and civilians, but mm-hmm. also there was a sense among women physicians that they wanted to see, you know, can we send women over to assist? Can women physicians go? This was also part of their push to gain commissions in the military, but mm-hmm. simultaneously they were forming these all-female units.
Mm-hmm.
But Lovejoy's visit to northern France and to Paris had a number of results of that, and one of them was that she worked with refugees. She went to Avignon and to some of the other mm-hmm. places where refugees were being repatriated. And so her interviews and her discussion with women was certainly important in her articulating the idea that, yes, rape had happened. But it was also, hers was a view that rape is not only a German soldier coming in to a community and sexually assaulting someone, but also women lost agency, they lost mm-hmm. control of their bodies and their condition when they were impoverished and mm-hmm. they were living in a city of occupation mm-hmm. and perhaps forming a relationship with a German soldier was a way to survive, and that might uh-huh. include sexual services. So
yeah.
I think she was thinking about that. A number of international leaders were. Jane Addams talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
Lila Rupp's work on international women also suggests that women activists were talking about it. It was not, they don't always use the language, and they didn't always use the language rape, but they talked about yeah. women's victimization. But
mm-hmm.
to your point, a number of historians have tried to address this issue and particularly locating that within the context of the First World War. I think
mm-hmm.
it's important not to say when war happens, rape always happens, but to
mm-hmm.
try to think about the specific ways and reasons why that was the case, or if it was the case, why that particular time period. So
yeah, the only reason I mentioned is, as I said, I was taught that it was entirely a kind of the product of Allied propagandists, you know, because that was
yes.
the moment at which propaganda was invented. Although I would have to say, you know, rape and war seem to unfortunately go together, so I'd be surprised that if there weren't some of it. But in any case, let's go on to talk about the three groups that you deal with in the book, that is the doctors, the nurses, and the women at arms. Can you tell us a little bit about each of them and how you investigated them?
Yes. The first group I'll characterize as women at arms. And I began to learn about them reading women's magazines,
mm-hmm.
ironically, such as The Delineator, which was the sewing pattern book in popular women's magazines.
Really? Wow.
And Good Housekeeping and some of the other magazines to see about the topics there and what those might reveal. And interestingly, I mean, these were women present in the pages of these women's magazines. And in fact, The Delineator raised, the editor of The Delineator, Ermine Ridgway, raised the question of women's military preparedness in 1915 in the delineator. So it's part of this preparedness activity. But I think that my sense is looking at those sources. Also, I looked at a variety of newspapers and also the Journal of the American Rifle Association. It was called Arms and the Man.
Yeah.
And across their pages, there are women who are forming gun clubs, defense groups. Some women workers formed them as well.
Uh-huh.
And advertisers were also representing women who were taking up arms and marketing to them, literally. And across the sources, just a very long list of these women's organizations. Some of them were gun clubs. Some of them had a more expansive program of military drill and training.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, this is true. There are women who do this in Canada. There are women who are doing this in Great Britain with the voluntary auxiliary. So the United States is not new. But some of these women linked this to home defense, to defense of this. In fact, Lorana Shelton, who was the leader of one of these groups, said that, you know, we're not going to be helpless as the Belgian women were.
Right.
And ourselves if men fail us. So they're articulating and making that link, but also saying that perhaps they might be a women's army. There were reports that there were some regiments that, of women shooting that wanted to, you know, offer their services to the military. June Houghton's group did. And, of course, they weren't accepted, but their motives were complicated. And I think, I believe that they saw this as a patriotic act, but also a way to define themselves as women who could defend themselves from violence should they encounter it. And they were not, they didn't make distinctions really between violence from so-called enemies and violence from more intimate violence and domestic violence.
And how were they looked upon by the wider culture? How were they treated in the mainstream press?
The mainstream press reported on them. The New York Times, for example, reported on the American Women's League for Self-Defense. So going back to, say, Kathleen Kennedy's work about women who were accused of subverting patriotism and who were considered dangerous, this, you know, in some ways, these women used arguments of patriotism and used arguments of, you know, gaining useful skills should the nation be invaded as a way to legitimize their activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some sort of straight reporting, but also there was a lot of ridicule, and particularly when you combine that with the construction of the female soldier, the Russian Women's Battalion of Death, they were ridiculed. I'm thinking about Linda Hart's work about how lesbians are associated with violence, and so there was a great deal of representation of women as lesbians or those who might become involved in same-sex relationships because of their military service.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the representations of female soldiers became very negative and focused on their sexuality, whether it was heterosexuality, meaning that they would be dangerous on the battlefield because they would be engaged in heterosexual acts, or that they might be dangerous because they would not need men and that they would be involved in same-sex affairs and so forth. So they were managed in many ways in this very strong backlash against the female soldier in Russia. The female soldiers in the United States came in for that same backlash. Neurologist Graham Hammond talked about, you know, that they were really distorted, and that they were, you know, that they deserved violence, that they deserved the violence that they might initiate.
Yeah. How are they seen by other women in the suffrage movement? Not to say that they themselves were in the suffrage movement, but how did the suffrage movement look on them?
If you look at some of the responses in the suffrage press, the Woman Citizen, for example, the Woman Citizen for a long time had presented the individual accomplishments of women. So initially, you know, there are some reports of this, but they're not, by 1918, they're not reporting about these women. And, mm-hmm. and so I think that suffragists, particularly if you think of the mainstream NASA and Carrie Chapman Catt, for expediency, left her anti-war activities and directed NASA and the mainstream organization to activities that would be supportive of the war. And so, in as much as these activities could be brought within that purview, that mm-hmm. they would support. But early on, there are statements such as, you know, these are women soldiers put to rest the argument that, you know, if women don't bear arms, they can't vote. And so they're using that as, again, embracing that as part of the definition of a full female citizenship.
Does anybody support that argument? I mean, in the broader culture, do people say, yes, well, you're absolutely right. If, you know, these two things are linked, and so we should actually, you know, bring women into the military if we're going to give them the right to vote.
Well, one of the important things that Kristen Hoganson's work about imperialism and the Spanish-American War and gender issues, one of the important things that her work does is to locate a resurgence of the argument about equating bullets and ballots with the Spanish-American War uh-huh. and the United States imperialism. And so the argument was had been renewed at that time, and so it was definitely a part of the discussion of suffrage prior to World War One.
Uh-huh.
And so there are a number of women who say being part of the military is part of a fuller female citizenship.
Yeah.
But it is not necessarily that they're arguing for armed combat. This is the argument that women physicians make for why they should have commissions in the military medical corps on an equal basis with men.
Uh-huh.
Nurses are asking for ranks. So there are certainly a number of groups that are calling for inclusion of women in the institution of the military, but that also has to do with professional equality, mm-hmm. Economic equality, and you know, sort of recognizing their professional credentials as much as their as being women.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about actually the institutional role that women played in the military in, let's say, 1915 or 1916. What sorts of roles could women play in the armed forces in the United States?
The Army Nurse Corps was created and established in 1901 following the Spanish-American War. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, there had been a nurse corps that had been part of the Union forces. Confederate was federated. But those were linked specifically to the conflict. There was not an institutional role for women in the military.
So they were going to time out at the end of the conflict, in other words.
Right.
Okay.
And so for the Spanish-American War, for example, women served as civilian. They were still civilians. They were contract workers.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have a contract for a length of time with the military. So it's clear that that was a temporary relationship.
They
and
had,
there were no promises of rank or equal pay or anything like that.
Exactly. They had no rank at all. They were inductees.
That's right. Actually, yeah. They were contractors.
Yeah, right. Okay.
They would contract their services.
I see.
So
okay.
They were, theirs was a, there was as much distance from them and an official military role as possible.
I see, okay.
Anita McGee, who was herself a physician, became the first director of the Army Nurse Corps in 1901. And so mm-hmm. that institutional place was established, but nurses, even after 1901, did not have rank in that military system that depended on that. So that was really the beginning. And then women were hired as members of the Signal Corps. The Army became an employer, if you will, during World War One, and this is where Susan Zeiger's book is really great.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of nursing, then women, they were the only women that the Army had really recognized as being, as part of the institution of the military when the United States began to prepare for the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
There had been some women who had served as contract nurses who were physicians.
Mm-hmm.
Anita McGee is the example there. And so there had been a few women physicians, but again, on that ad hoc basis.
Mm-hmm.
Nurses have the... It's a small foundation, but they have really the only foundation upon which to build.
I see. And they argued that they should receive official rank. Is that correct? Or at least some of them did.
They did. They did. And there was a great call. In fact, there were many shortages of nurses during the First World War. And then, of course, in the fall of 1918 with the influenza pandemic, there were crucial shortages of nurses. And so there's a great deal of support from suffragists such as Harriet Stanton Blatch, Helen Hoy Greeley, who became the legal counsel for the Committee to Secure Rank for Nurses. So there were nursing leaders and suffrage leaders and rank and file nurses who supported the call for rank in the military. They were asking for officer status within the military. So that was a campaign that was conducted by nursing leaders outside of the military, by suffragists who equated nurses' work in the military, they equated that with their own voteless status. They felt that nurses also did not have an official place. They were not officially recognized. So there was resonance there. And so this is another example of suffragists supporting women's call for military rank. And so the campaign lasted across the conflict, and after the conflict in 1920, nurses received relative rank. But my research focused particularly on the response of rank and file nurses, particularly after they returned home.
Mm-hmm.
And they linked... They linked their call for military rank to what they identified as what we would call a hostile workplace or a gender discrimination was happening there.
Mm-hmm.
So they saw that if they were to enter the military, that they also wanted to shape the military and address the violence that they saw happening in a hostile workplace. So they talked about... male members of the medical corps, whether it be the corpsmen, the orderlies, or the surgeons, as taking liberties with them, or one great phrase, treating it as a Coney Island dance hall. They were talking about, they were talking about a hostile environment, and so some nurses believed that rank would help them and help create a safer workplace. There was a tremendous shift during the war as base hospitals that had been organized stateside. Suddenly you have new personnel, leaders come and go, and the cohesion that you might have had before that is all gone. And so there was a really vulnerable workplace there. So many rank and file nurses support the idea of military rank. A number of them are concerned that rank would separate them from the enlisted men with whom they associated. If they were officers, they couldn't associate with enlisted men.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them felt that military rank really wouldn't solve the problem of a hostile workplace. But one of the things that I wanted to emphasize in this study is that the discussion was happening, and particularly was happening as nurses returned home and they were demobilized and they were no longer planning to be in the military themselves, and so they felt freer to comment and to raise this issue to become active in this campaign because they were out of the military, but they knew that nurses would continue to be a part of that, and I think they wanted to address that for nurses as a whole institutionally.
And could you tell us a little bit about the doctors then? Now, they wanted commissions, as I understood, right?
Yes. The Medical Women's National Association had had been formed in 1915.
I have to say, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have to say, and again, my ignorance is on my sleeve, I was amazed that there were, you say, 6,000 female doctors in the United States. At the time. I had no idea that there were any female doctors at the time.
Well, I recommend Regina Moran Sanchez.
Right. I'm always amazed at the things I don't know. I just had no idea. So.
But I also think that, again, women physicians had, in the United States, and this is certainly true in the work that I've seen in, for example, in Great Britain, that women physicians were receiving, they were being legitimized because public health, social medicine, those were programs that were certainly mm-hmm. part of the United States Progressive mm-hmm. Era. So
sure, yeah.
public health nursing and, city health offices are addressing outbreaks of disease, and they're immunizing people and mm-hmm. inspecting schools, clean water, clean food,
right.
Upton Sinclair in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense, women physicians believe that they have really been achieving professional legitimacy. So yes, the almost 6,000 and the Medical Women's National Association in their convention in 1917 formed a war service committee. And their strategy was, first of all, to conduct a registration. And this had two purposes. First, it would demonstrate how many, it would demonstrate how many women physicians were out there and that they were a force to be reckoned with.
Uh-huh.
While 6,000 is not a lot in terms of the profession, they were, approaching something like 6-7%. But also to show that women physicians were prepared, that they could be called upon by the nation,
mm-hmm.
That they wanted to engage in this service. But also it kind of acted as a petition to the War Department that, they wanted this service. So
mm-hmm.
there's a tremendous amount of activity around the country among particularly organized medical women who are part of these societies to
mm-hmm.
complete this registration and to show the government that they were there and ready. And actually, this is it's published as the Census of Women Physicians, and I did a statistical analysis of that and tried
what
to
a great
find
source,
out
though, isn't it, though? I mean, that's just a fantastic
a
source.
Source.
That's amazing. I would just, I envy you very much for having a source like that. Go
but
ahead,
there were
Lisa.
Also, so this was kind of a larger effort. There were also local efforts so that for Portland, Oregon women just presented their credentials at the Vancouver, Washington barracks and said, we're here to enlist.
Uh-huh.
And Mary Bates and her Colorado women's group eventually created kind of a national test case that I talked
uh-huh.
about. And so part of what makes this effective is that there's the Medical Women's Journal that's reaching all these medical women. They're in communication with one another. There are local societies. And so, their prior organization and their prior work in kind of organizing together with other community organizations like the Consumers League and passing legislation, they have that network in place so they can
uh-huh.
get the word out about this. Anyway, they... Secretary of War Baker says no. They take this to the AMA. They want to support that. There was partial support with the AMA. They were concerned about equal pay for equal work, if you will. They felt that if physicians happened to be women and they were accepted, they wanted them to be accepted fully. But
mm-hmm.
they were not as enthusiastic about, a complete acceptance of women. And so at the same time that this is going on, women like Esther Lovejoy, who are visiting France, early on in the conflict, also see the need for all-female medical units. In other words,
yeah,
we can offer our services to the U.S. government, but while all that's going on, we see a real need to address civilian health care. This is, the broad stage of public health there could be
mm-hmm.
nothing more important. So it's not only addressing the care of the wounded, but the civilians and typhoid epidemics.
But why did they want all female medical units? Why not mixed gender?
That way you could show that women could do it.
I see.
And you're showcasing
okay.
women's service.
I see.
Yeah.
Unaided by men. Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah.
So, yeah, right.
Yeah.
The Medical Women's National Association sent Several groups, the American Women's Hospitals was their organization, also the National American Suffrage Association, the mainstream suffrage association, yeah, sponsored the Women's Overseas Hospital. So again, suffrage and wartime service, there's that support. So that's another demonstration of the way in which many women saw this as connected to female citizenship. And so for the women physicians, it's about claiming equality within the military, but also, you know, the idea that citizenship is more than the vote. It's about professional equality. It's about having the opportunity to serve in the military if we wish to do that, but on equal terms with men. And in the meantime, addressing these all-female units, particularly the Medical Women's National Association, but certainly all the groups that I saw, talked about and worried about and were concerned about how to provide a response to the particular ways that war brought violence to women.
Mm-hmm.
And Esther Lovejoy, who made her visit to France early on, went to Paris. She said, the French midwives are doing just fine. They don't need American women to come over and take over and do their jobs. Mm-hmm. We can come and provide dispensaries. We can provide the support to healthcare providers there.
Uh-huh.
We can address this. And so they addressed the problem of wartime rape, but also what it meant to be in an occupied condition, uh-huh, and what it meant to be returning to a home or having your home devastated, so that malnutrition, epidemic disease, poverty, all were ways that war violence visited women and children, mm-hmm, particularly. So mm-hmm, they wanted to address that with those all-female medical, mm-hmm, units.
I see. So tell us how successful each of these groups were after the war in fulfilling their agenda.
In my view...
That's the view we want.
...contextualize the post-war period, because... Uh-huh. One of the things that happens is that there's a great fear about the potential violence of returning veterans,
uh-huh,
male veterans.
Uh-huh.
And one of the threads that we haven't talked about through this is the idea that shell shock represented the psychological devastation was something that medical personnel and social workers and others were really worried about, because,
uh-huh,
it was sort of uncertain what would happen, and perhaps it would create one person called the habits of violence after wartime. And,
uh-huh,
so there's a great worry about that. And so there's a great deal of popular discussion and pressure and, of course, economic decisions that are made to really... reconstruct women's roles so that they would not be preserving the gains in the workplace or within the military, and,
mm-hmm,
that women really have this post-war bargain. If they want safety, they need to get married.
I see.
And men need the jobs, they don't need them. So many of their claims, in a broad sense, are reversed in the backlash following the war. In terms of these three groups, women physicians were the most effective because they were able to establish these all-female medical units.
Uh-huh.
They did not achieve medical commissions, and they were very distraught about that. But they also, for example, the American Women's Hospitals continued under the direction of Esther Lovejoy,
uh-huh,
to become a very a significant contributor in post-war medical relief, and the Medical Women's International Association is formed.
Esther Lovejoy sounds like quite a person.
She is, and she's my next topic. So.
Oh, is she really? That's,
yes,
funny, because I was going to mention that. It sounds like a great topic,
yes,
for a biography.
Yes,
anyway,
absolutely.
Go ahead. Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. I really was thinking that. I was thinking that.
I'm getting my plugs in early.
Yeah, no.
But I think they were very disappointed because they believed that they had the credentials and that their claims for medical commissions and citizenship, the links there, and professional, you know, preparation were there. And so they were arguing for, they were acting on behalf of civilian women in France, mm-hmm, for example. And so when they articulated an anti-violence and talked about violence against women, it was not really about themselves. And, mm-hmm, so it was it was safer, if you will. And they did, I think, while not successful in their claims, they did lay the groundwork for the movement that would be successful for women in the Second World War in terms of their goal of achieving officer status.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they also were very concerned about what being a part of the military meant. Many women physicians, Lovejoy, for example, turned very powerfully anti-war after the conflict. And so there were ways in which I think they, in addressing violence against women in war through these all-female medical units, articulated a critique of militarism and a critique of war's violence that I think had an important legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Nurses received relative rank, and so, again, that was a halfway measure. But I also think it's important because in their campaign, they linked a hostile working environment with, again, violence against women, and they linked the solution as a regular official rank within the institution, or at least some of them did, as a way to achieve that. And so I think their campaign is an important chapter in women's anti-violence activism. So they, again, I think it's important to know that they failed, but also to understand how they made their arguments, and they named the violence against women and sought a way to remedy that.
Mm-hmm.
The women who were part of the paramilitary organizations were the least successful, and I think that's because they were the most threatening.
Yeah.
And they, because they were not talking, in some ways they were talking about an enemy and danger from an enemy, but they were also talking about domestic violence and for women to be able to defend themselves and indeed to claim that right to defend themselves as part of citizenship is quite a powerful threat.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, I think the most powerful backlash was against them.
Mm-hmm. I see. So just to conclude the story, for those of us who don't know, and I'm one of them, women get the vote in 21 or 22, is that correct?
There were women about a dozen states. In about a dozen states, for example, in Oregon in 1912, women achieved the vote, full vote. But the 19th Amendment is ratified by the states in August of 1920.
Uh-huh. I see. And then when do women actually enter the military? When is the WACs and the WAVES and these other things that
that's
we might
World
be familiar
War
with? When
II.
Are they? Yes, they're all created during World War II?
Yes.
That's very interesting.
And so, again, there are very important, very powerful questions about the impact of militarization on women. And one of my sort of essential reading on this is Cynthia Enloe and her work on militarization and now certainly militarization and globalization. But Enloe's work is very thoughtful and very important in thinking about the ways that women have been militarized both inside and outside of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And so World War II is the site for that. And in some ways, the First World War represents the first real bureaucratic war. For example, Secretary of the Navy Josephus Daniels in the First World War finds a loophole so that women are recruited for the Navy and Marine Corps as clerks, as office workers. The idea is that they will free men for combat.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I guess I just want to return to that idea that in some ways, if it's the case that women come to the military because they're freeing men for combat or shaming men into military service, I think it's clear why there might be a very strong backlash against that, because that's you know, a very powerful way in which it's sending men to danger and then creating more danger for men. So, in any case, so there's that World War I precedent. But World War II, the great mobilization that happened and also the duration of the conflict, plus the context and the foundation that the work of these women in the First World War had established, I think, is the reason for that.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Is there a book that you could recommend on the mobilization of women during World War II to our audience? Has people written about this?
Yes, Lisa Meyer's book, Creating G.I. Jane.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I see.
Would be my recommendation.
Okay. Well, you know, we've taken up a lot of your time today, and we really appreciate it. It's a fascinating book. The book is Mobilizing Minerva, American Women in the First World War, which has just come out from the University of Illinois Press. And as is our normal practice here on New Books in History, let me ask you this. What are you working on now? Actually, we already know the answer to that question, but go ahead.
You know the answer. As I was completing some work on this book, I found that Esther Lovejoy's papers had just been, well, they'd been processed at the Oregon Health and Science University Archives
uh-huh.
in 2001.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been among the first scholars to look at her papers. Her papers also are at the Drexel University College of Medicine, the Philadelphia Archive, where the women's medical college used to be. At any rate, Lovejoy's biography offers me an opportunity to situate her as an early medical woman. She was Portland's city health officer from 1907 to 1909, the first woman
uh-huh.
to be a health officer in a city that large. She
uh-huh.
was an Oregon suffragist. She was active in World War I, as we've seen. She became a historian of women in medicine, but also she directed the American Women's Hospitals, which had been formed, as we've read, by, you know, in World War I. After the war, she transformed it into a Without Borders medical relief organization and used her role as one of the organizers and founders of the Medical Women's International Association to try to... She had a theory of international health in which women physicians would have a strong role in promoting peace by promoting healthy communities and policies that mm-hmm. would lead to that. So she's very much a part of that transnational activism of women following World War I.
What a fantastic topic.
And she worked with Vera Lebedeva, who was the director of the Office for Protection of Motherhood and Children in the new Soviet Union.
Oh, really?
Wow. A lot of borders.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. No, it sounds like a terrific topic. You know, I've always personally wanted to write a biography. Is it going to be a biography? Is it going to be a study of her and her times?
It's going to be a biography, life and times.
I am so envious of you, I can't even begin to say. I've always wanted to write a biography, but I don't think I'm really up to the task. Also, the period in which I study, or I used to study, I suppose, it's basically impossible to write anybody's biography because there just isn't enough known about anyone. So I'm green here in Iowa with envy. Because
yeah.
Esther Lovejoy sounds like an absolutely terrific topic, and we look forward to seeing that book in a few years.
Marshall, thank you very much.
And when you finish it, we'll interview you again, and we can continue our topic about Esther Lovejoy. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, anyway, Kim, thank you very much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome.
All right. Okay, well, you take care now.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Kim Jensen, author of Mobilizing Minerva, American Women in the First World War. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. We'll talk to you next week.